The hits just keep on coming for Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. A special panel is recommending that the Senate take up the question of whether she can do her job with a suspended law license. Kane's license was suspended last month, and she faces perjury and other criminal charges. As soon as December 10th, the full chamber could start a process that would include a public hearing to allow Kane to defend herself. And at that point, top Senate GOP aide Drew Crompton says the Senate could ask the governor to remove Kane with a two-thirds majority vote.
I think we're being judicious. I think we're being meticulous in the process. We want to be deliberate. This is a big deal. This is a very significant issue that the Senate has presented.
Kane, in turn, plans to announce a team of special prosecutors next Tuesday to investigate public email accounts and servers that have trafficked in pornographic and offensive emails. For the past month, Democrats have called for a special prosecutor to investigate the extent of inappropriate emails that have already implicated state and county prosecutors, as well as judges, agents within the state attorney general's office, and others. Kane's office spokesperson says the review will examine governmental email addresses that have already been uncovered on Office of Attorney General servers. Meanwhile, members of the Pennsylvania House are moving on a separate track to remove Kane from office. Joining me to talk about that effort is Republican Lycoming County Representative Garth Everett. He plans to introduce a resolution to begin a Judiciary Committee investigation of Kane. Mr. Everett, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
It's a pleasure, Dave.
Representative Everett, tell us about these House efforts to remove Kane from office.
This would establish an investigatory committee under the House Judiciary Committee that would have subpoena power and would have the authority to investigate allegations that have been made against Attorney General Kane to determine if impeachment is warranted. You know, we've heard a lot of information in the newspapers and leaks from grand juries, things that the Attorney General has said, and we just think that there's enough there that an investigation is warranted to determine if we would want to proceed with an impeachment process.
This cannot be completed in the House, though. It would then go on to the Senate for a trial.
Right. The actual trial of an impeachment does take place in the Senate. It starts in the House, and we just feel that that Attorney General Kane is entitled to due process. I mean, we could skip this investigatory step and just recommend impeachment, but we want to make sure that the grounds are there.
To what extent do you sense that this momentum enjoys bipartisan support in Harrisburg?
There's another resolution that was circulated earlier by Representative Daryl Metcalf, who's the chairman of the State Government Committee, and there were individuals from the Democratic Party who signed on to that resolution. And, you know, and also, I mean, even the governor had at one point, you know, I think voiced that he thought the attorney general should resign. And she's refused to do that. So we just think as this case continues to build and one thing after another comes out about her, that it's time to start an investigation. The committee that does the investigation will be bipartisan. And this is not a partisan action by any stretch. It's just done out of concern that the Attorney General is so distracted by all these other issues that she's just unable to do her job and not in a position where she can do the things she needs to do to be our Attorney General.
But again, to be clear, she is entitled to due process, and to the extent that these criminal charges are pending, you're satisfied that this investigation on the part of the House is not premature?
No, I think that the two things can be on a parallel track. And, you know, our determination of impeachment is a different standard and has different criteria than the criminal investigation. We'll be using some of the information from the investigation to as part of our investigation. We'll be using the information that and I've not seen the Senate's report on their investigation of whether they feel that she can carry on her office without a law license, but that would be part of our investigation, bringing that information in, and then looking at everything in the totality to determine if we feel that she needs to be removed from office.
Holiday greetings to you and your family. Thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Okay, thank you, and have a good holiday.
That's Republican Lycoming County Representative Garth Everett. Everett, a member of the State House Appropriations Committee, has been summoned to Harrisburg Monday afternoon for what will hopefully be the end of the state's five-month-long budget standoff. Any agreement, though, will not include a severance tax on Marcellus shale drilling, a campaign promise of Governor Tom Wolf. So how exactly did the severance tax get scrapped? State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick offers this explanation.
The answer is pretty simple. Lawmakers who loathe raising taxes and lobbyists. It was obvious over the summer, right before the July 1st budget deadline. Republican House Speaker Mike Terzai called a press conference and railed against the tax.
I think the governor's severance tax proposals are designed to stop the growth of natural gas, and it is going to stop energy independence, and it is going to stop the growth of jobs in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
As Terzai stood in front of a group of reporters and TV cameras at the Capitol, there was another crowd off to his left. More than half a dozen oil and gas lobbyists watched as Terzai read directly from a booklet of talking points emblazoned with the logo of EQT. That's one of the biggest drillers near his home district in southwestern Pennsylvania.
The effective rate for the governor's severance tax that he has put on the table is essentially, for the southwest region of the state, about 15%.
Terzai declined to comment for this story. But the legislature's failure to implement a severance tax doesn't surprise Barry Kaufman. He's the executive director of the nonpartisan government reform group Common Cause Pennsylvania. His group has closely tracked campaign contributions and lobbying expenditures of Marcellus drillers. During last year's election, they spent nearly $18 million on lobbying alone.
Our elected officials know where the bread is being buttered. You know, Pennsylvania is one of only 11 states that has no limits on campaign contributions. That is just completely absurd.
Even though drillers additionally gave close to $3 million in campaign contributions, Wolf made taxing the industry a key part of his gubernatorial campaign last year.
As your governor, I will lead.
He saturated the airwaves with TV ads, saying he'd use that money from drilling to fund public education.
Close corporate tax loopholes and make the gas companies pay up to fund our schools. After all, it's time to get Pennsylvania moving again.
But these days, nearly 5 months into a state budget stalemate, things don't seem to be moving anywhere. And until recently, the severance tax was a major sticking point. Now Wolf says he's given up on pushing for it this year. And he acknowledges his earlier statements that the tax could raise $1 billion proved to be unrealistic.
Yeah, I know, I recognize the mathematics are very different, but I can't tell you what is motivating people who are against it. This is something that the overwhelming majority of Pennsylvanians want.
The tax debate stretches back to the beginning of the shale boom itself. Back in 2009, a democratically controlled House passed a severance tax, but it was opposed by the Republican Senate. Then again last year, Republican Governor Tom Corbett, who generally opposed the idea, signaled he was open to it. And over time, the arguments against the tax have changed. Sometimes the industry is described as taking its first uncertain steps.
We are very much still in the infancy and the early development of this play.
That's Dave Spiegelmeyer, head of the industry trade group, the Marcellus Shale Coalition. At other times, he said drillers could just get up and walk away if the tax burden is too heavy.
It makes us uncompetitive with Ohio, it makes us uncompetitive with Texas, it makes us uncompetitive with Louisiana, it makes us uncompetitive with China. Capital can move like water in Pennsylvania, move from Pennsylvania pretty quickly.
Lately, lobbyists have been telling legislators that the industry is on its knees. Drillers are cutting costs and laying people off because the glut of gas and subsequent low prices have hurt drillers badly. With the state continuing to face large deficits, though, the need to find additional revenue grows. So a natural gas severance tax will most likely be part of the discussion. Whether it becomes a reality remains to be seen. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
A new federal survey from the Department of Housing and Urban Development finds that homelessness among veterans is easing. Yet the report also notes that in Chester County, more and more veterans are losing housing. WHYY's Bobby Allen reports that the government has declared Chester one of the worst areas for housing vets.
One of the big reasons is because there's a VA hospital in Coatesville, and vets come from all over the tri-state area for care. but many fall on hard times when they're released.
You can tell people, you know, up and down that homelessness is an issue in Chester County, specifically for veterans, but because it's such an affluent county, it's really hard to believe.
Lauren Hutzel is with the county's Department of Community Development. She says, hopefully, Chester County's poor ranking can be used to make the case for more government funding for shelter services. In Philadelphia, meanwhile, the numbers more or less stayed the same over 5 years. Around 6,000 live in shelters or on the street. That's less than 1% of the city's population.
6,000 is still a lot. It's a lot more than what we have the resources to really accommodate.
Laura Weinbaum is a spokeswoman with Project Home. She says those who are doubled up out of economic necessity or who have precarious living situations are not encompassed in that number.
Frankly, you know, this time of year we start to think about people living with no heat or electricity in their homes. It's not capturing any of those kinds of experiences of homelessness.
And there are fluctuations. She says about 1 in 10 people living in poverty can expect to experience homelessness at some point over the course of a year. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
Turning to this evening's headlines, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie has pardoned a 61-year-old Philadelphia man with a record of drug use, saying he turned his life around after a 1972 robbery conviction in Atlantic City. Christie signed the pardon today at the State House in Trenton alongside John Berry, who's been sober for nearly 30 years. A state trooper shot during yesterday's chaotic car chase with a teen suspect on Philadelphia's Vine Street Expressway has been released after spending a day in the hospital. Trooper Patrick Casey tells WPVI-TV that he feels better and is happy to be going home for Thanksgiving. 45 degrees, clear skies on Independence Mall. It's 6:16. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. We're asking listeners to help us create radio programming that's excellent and suited to the needs of our audience and region. Participate by taking our survey at whyy.org/survey. Still ahead, take a walk around the Philadelphia Waterworks and you'll find meticulously maintained statues and structures.
All of which look as good as they must have in about 1840. One couldn't have said that 30, 40, 50 years ago at all.
A new book details just how far Fairmount Park has come in the past half century. Details when Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY.
Fox Chase Cancer Center, part of Temple Health, supports WHYY and Lung Cancer Awareness Month. As a major research center, Fox Chase offers both lung cancer screening and advanced treatments for lung cancer, including immunotherapy, chemoradiation, and minimally invasive and robotic lung surgery. In addition, Fox Chase is constantly working to develop new ways to fight lung cancer. Their clinical trials give patients access to new options, sometimes years before they become widely available. Learn more at foxchase.org.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Foundation distributes more than $1 million annually in scholarships to southeastern Pennsylvania students. Individuals, businesses, and educational institutions can set up a customized permanent scholarship fund through the foundation and receive tax benefits while helping students achieve their dreams. The foundation helps make it easy by taking care of paperwork and accounting. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philafound.org.
Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Tucked away in Philadelphia's Germantown neighborhood is a music studio that serves as a collaborative space for musicians who have other careers or who've been on the margins of the music industry for a long time. WHYY's Aaron Moselle takes us there.
But I was a little faster than you, you said.
Because I know you know the pattern. So, right. That's why when you sang it, see how shorter it is?
Yeah.
On the second floor of an old surgical textile mill, Irv Jean-Baptiste is getting ready to rehearse a love song Craig McJett wrote for his wife. Jean-Baptiste is a 24-year-old college student. McJett is a 58-year-old private investigator.
Good collaboration. What? My grandson and grandpa.
My time here on earth with you makes me realize love is true. As time flies by and by, we will conquer all with pride.
The two met as members of Working While Playing. The program in Philadelphia's Germantown neighborhood offers musicians an affordable space to practice or record. For Jean-Baptiste, it's a place to relax and grow as a person.
It serves as, I want to say experience, but not just experience. It serves as a free space, you know, just to get my thought processes out.
It's where McJet releases his inner hippie.
I always dreamed of myself going up on stage, like my first concert, 1973, Earth, Wind & Fire, and Maurice White, the lead singer, was like, we play so beautifully, don't you agree? And it just hit me. Do you remember
when it first started? All these years later, he couldn't be happier that music has become a bigger part of his life.
It just makes me free of heart. I just feel like I'm 16 again.
Working while playing is the brainchild of Adam Monaco and Danny Jackson, two longtime friends. Monaco plays mandolin, Jackson the guitar. While renting a house in the suburbs, musicians often pass through to record in a makeshift studio Monaco built on the top floor.
One day, Danny, we're just having breakfast. She's like, I got an idea. She's like, we should make this a thing. Like, people need this. We should create something that we wish we had. And so that's kind of the birth of it. And then we spent many a days at Saxby's in Ardmore game planning.
Monaco says part of the mission is to give disillusioned musicians a place to rediscover the joy and power of playing.
It was a way to express themselves. It was a way to comfort themselves and get through whatever rough times they're getting through. And the second you let that die, you know, you're not yourself. You're not your whole self.
Members can use the space for as little as $35 a month. Every package requires 2 hours of community service. To compare, time at a regular recording studio can cost upwards of $100 an hour. For Jackson, that combination of cash and community service just makes sense.
I have a holistic belief that musicians have a unique position to be the best servant leaders in communities because that's what we do. We get on stage and we connect with people. And if you can actually get musicians to actually do more community service, patronize the people who are patronizing you, you know, it's, to me, it's elemental to like your success as a musician.
What I have for her is a discharge summary.
On stage, L. John Doe leads L and the John Doe Band, an R&B funk group. But Monday through Friday, she's a substance abuse case manager finding spaces at inpatient facilities for those trying to break an addiction. For her, the community service component of working while playing is rewarding.
You need to give back in order to, you know, sort of just come to terms with the fact that we all sort of need help, and so we all need to give back. No one can do anything all by themselves, and there's so many people out there that need help and don't have the opportunity to get it.
It's a message Adam Monaco and Danny Jackson hope to spread through music, across the city, and one day, the globe. I'm Aaron Mozell, WHYY News.
It's the pride of Philadelphia. Fairmount Park is considered to be one of the world's finest urban parks. It wasn't always so. The legacy is laid out in a new book entitled City in a Park, A History of Philadelphia's Fairmount Park System. Joining me are the book's authors, James McClellan, Executive Director Emeritus of the Philadelphia Art Alliance, and Lynn Miller, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Temple University. Jim, Lynn, welcome to Newsworks Tonight.
Thank you. Thanks. Nice to be here.
Jim, the book is its own description, a celebration of Fairmount Park, which was established to protect Philadelphia's water supply.
Correct.
Take us back to those dicey days in the late 18th and early 19th century where plague broke out repeatedly.
Yes, that yellow fever particularly, and it was discovered by city fathers that this was coming from polluted streams and our water supply was terrible. So they knew they had to do something about it because the city was growing by leaps and bounds.
So what came of the effort?
Well, what came of the effort?
Philadelphia Water Works?
The Philadelphia Water Works, yes. They had started with a pump system at Center Square, which is where City Hall stands today. And they had a pumping station there, which pumped water from the Schuylkill through wooden pipes that were sent through the city.
It was, by the way, the first municipal water system in the whole world. starting in 1799. Nothing past the Roman age, I think, had done anything like this before. Once the decision was made just after the turn of the 19th century to move the waterworks from Center Square up to what William Penn had called Fair Mount, that highest point just outside the city boundary, from that point on, that area right around Fairmount became a pleasure ground. And then, as the park expanded, largely in the decade right after the Civil War, all the way up the Schuylkill, the whole thing became a pleasure ground.
The name, City in a Park, what were you thinking of with that?
Well, among the many photos in the book is a photograph taken from Belmont Plateau, which shows the city skyline in the background and in the foreground, the parkland. And that really gave us the idea for the title of the book when we saw that finished photograph.
We also are very much aware, as we worked on the book, that park acreage has been increasing, particularly under the Nutter administration. There are now something like 11,000 acres of parkland in Philadelphia, and somebody, someplace, used this phrase, it's becoming a city in a park. We thought that was catchy, and that's why we used it.
One way to appreciate where the park is now is to look at where it came from and speak of that dark period, this downward spiral of disrepair.
Philadelphia was in decline for several decades following World War II. That is to say, the population was diminishing, and certainly there were fewer and fewer bucks to spend on the parks. It showed in, for example, the decline of the structures at the waterworks and elsewhere. And starting in about 1980 or 90, money began to be raised privately by a variety of groups to restore so much that had been deteriorating. If you go to the Fairmount Waterworks today, you will see structures including pavilions, walkways along the edge of the mountain, all of which look as good as they must have in about 1840. One couldn't have said that 30, 40, 50 years ago at all.
You're both so passionate about the subject, and it's such a wonderful park. Thank you for this book, and thanks for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thank you very much.
Lynn Miller, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Temple University, and James McClellan, Executive Director Emeritus of the Philadelphia Art Alliance. The book is entitled City in a Park, A History of Philadelphia's Fairmount Park System. Finally this evening, on the eve of Turkey Day, Philadelphia Mayor-elect Jim Kenney says Thanksgiving is way better than Christmas.
Let me wish everyone happy Thanksgiving. My favorite holiday, no pressure, no gifts, just food and football and a nap on the couch afterwards. That's about it.
Now, Kenny spent years as a mummer, so you might have thought his holiday of choice would be New Year's Day. But for mummers, and especially for fancy brigade members, there's months of practice leading up to a few minutes performing before judges, so some stress-free time could be good for the incoming mayor. We're thinking he's going to have a lot of stress on his plate after the first of the year. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov and Kimberly Haas. Find us on iTunes or listen at newsworks.org. Tomorrow evening, join us for a special Thanksgiving edition of Newsworks Tonight as we join with residents across the region to consider food and gratitude. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.
Frederick Living supports WHYY. Frederick Living, a continuing care retirement community nestled in the beautiful countryside of Montgomery County, is proud to announce the expansion of their campus. The meadows at Frederick Living will consist of 55 cottages clustered in an innovative design based on the pocket neighborhood concept. Frederick Living is now taking reservations. Visits can be scheduled by calling 610-754-7878. That's 610-754-7878. Frederick Living. Live well.
What good is sitting.
That's a 1965 demo recording of the title song from the musical Cabaret, performed by the songwriters John Kander and Fred Ebb, who also wrote the songs for Chicago, Flora the Red Menace, and the Scottsboro Boys. On the next Fresh Air, I'll talk with Kander about his new double CD, Hidden Treasures. Join us.
Tonight at 7 on WHYY-FM.
You're knitting your book and your broom.
This fall, only at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, Audubon to Warhol, The Art of American Still Life, revealing the simple beauty and meaning of everyday things. It makes the familiar fresh and enables us to see things in new and different ways, with masterpieces by such celebrated artists as Charles Wilson Peale, John James Audubon, Georgia O'Keeffe, and Andy Warhol. This is one of the largest exhibitions of American still life in over 30 years. Tickets at philamuseum.org. The Philadelphia Museum of Art supports WHYY.